October 31st, 1975, Greenwich, Connecticut. After she fails to return home from the previous night, the body of 15-year-old Martha Moxley is discovered in her backyard. She has been stabbed in the neck and bludgeoned with a golf club, and pieces of the shattered club are traced to the residence of a prominent family from the neighborhood. Decades later, one of the family's children, Michael Skakel, who was 15 at the time of the crime, is charged and convicted of Martha's murder. However, Michael's conviction winds up being vacated on two separate occasions due to ineffective counsel at his trial, so he is released from prison, and there are no conclusive answers about who was responsible for killing Martha. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we're about to begin a two-part series on what is undoubtedly one of the most controversial cases ever featured on this podcast, the 1975 murder of Martha Moxley. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Jeremy Indick Connolly, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Jeremy. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for 6 years now, so if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, you probably know that it's always been tradition for us to spend the month of October covering mysteries which have some sort of Halloween slant to them, and this is definitely one of the most infamous crimes to take place on or around October the 31st. It involves a 15-year-old girl named Martha Moxley, who lived in the affluent Belhaven neighborhood in Greenwich, Connecticut, and spent the evening before Halloween celebrating what was known in the area as Mischief Night, as it was common practice for the local teenagers to go out and play pranks. However, Martha never returned home, and the following day, she was found murdered in her own backyard. Pieces of a shattered golf club which had been used to repeatedly strike her head were found nearby, and this particular club would be traced to the residence of a family named the Skakels who lived across the street. The Skakels were known for being one of the most wealthy and prominent families in the area, as they were connected to none other than the Kennedy family, and over the years, three individuals who lived in their residence at the time would pop up on the radar as potential suspects. Over the years, there were a lot of rumors that the Skakels were using their influence to prevent anyone from being arrested for Martha's murder, but in the year 2000, charges were finally filed against one of the family's children, Michael Skakel, who was only 15 years old at the time of the crime, and was accused of attacking Martha in a jealous rage. When Michael went on trial, he was convicted on very circumstantial evidence, and there was a time when I wondered if this case could even be featured on The Trail Went Cold. Back when I started this podcast in early 2016, Michael Skakel's conviction had been overturned on the grounds of ineffective counsel, and he was out on bail awaiting a new trial, but by the end of the year, the Connecticut Supreme Court would vote to reinstate his conviction. However, in May of 2018, the court would reverse its own decision and vacate Michael's conviction again, and the state eventually announced that they had no intention of retrying him, as they did not feel confident that they could secure another guilty verdict after 4 decades. Of course, even though Michael is now a free man again, he has definitely not been exonerated, and while many people still believe he was guilty of the crime, he does have his fair share of supporters who have attempted to point the finger at alternate suspects. Since this is such a convoluted story which has dragged on for nearly 50 years without a conclusive resolution, I've decided to split my series into two parts. So on this particular episode, I will share all the facts and key information about the case, and next Wednesday, November the 1st, I'll release part 2 and provide my theories and analysis about what happened. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. I also just wanted to mention that we're now getting ever so close to attaining 500 Patreon subscribers, and if we manage to attain our goal by the end of October, we'll be providing an additional extra special bonus for all of our patrons in November. So with all that out of the way, let us now begin part one of our series about the murder of Martha Moxley. Our story begins in 1975 in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is located in the southwestern portion of the state in Fairfield County, about 35 miles away from New York City. Our central figure is 15-year-old Martha Moxley, who lives with her family on Walsh Lane in the affluent, gated Bell Haven neighborhood. Originally born in San Francisco to parents David and Dorothy Moxley, Martha also has a 17-year-old brother named John. The family have only lived in Greenwich for 14 months, as they relocated there from Piedmont, California, after David was transferred to the New York office of the accounting and management consulting firm Touche Ross & Company. Martha and her brother are currently attending Greenwich High School, and she is considered to be an excellent popular student who has gotten straight A's and was voted best personality in her class when she graduated from junior high school. On the evening of Thursday, October the 30th, in order to prepare for Halloween, Martha was hoping to hang out with her friends on what was known as Mischief Night, which would involve the local teenagers pulling such pranks as throwing toilet paper and eggs at houses in the neighborhood or ringing doorbells and running away before their occupants could answer them. The previous weekend, Martha had been grounded for staying out late with her boyfriend, Peter Saluka, but since her father was out of town on business and Halloween was going to be a school holiday, Dorothy Moxley agreed to allow Martha to go out, but told her to be home by 9:30 p.m. Martha eventually wound up at the residence of the Skakel family, who lived across the street from the Moxley residence 150 yards away at the corner of Walsh Lane and Otter Rock Drive. The Skakels were considered to be one of the most prominent families in Greenwich, as their patriarch, Rushton Skakel, was the heir to the Great Lakes Carbon Corporation. Rushton's sister also happened to be Ethel Skakel Kennedy, the widow of Senator Robert F. Kennedy, who had been the leading Democratic candidate to run for president of the United States before he was assassinated in June of 1968. In total, Rushton and his wife, Ann Skakel, had 7 children, which included an 18-year-old daughter named Julie and 6 sons, 19-year-old Rushton Jr., 17-year-old Tommy, 16-year-old John, 15-year-old Michael, 11-year-old David, and 9-year-old Stephen. However, the family would endure a major tragedy when Anne passed away of brain cancer in March of 1973 at the age of 41. Since Rushton Sr. was often out of town on business, the Skakel family were usually free to do whatever they wanted with very little adult supervision. Anyway, Martha spent a good chunk of Mischief Night hanging out with 2 of her friends, Helen Ickes and Jeffrey Byrne, before they wound up at the Skakel residence. Shortly before 9:30 p.m., the 3 of them were hanging around with 2 of the Skakel boys, Tommy and Michael, inside the family's Lincoln Continental, listening to music on the radio. One of the family's cousins, Jimmy Tarion, was visiting them that night, but he emerged from the residence alongside 2 of the other Skakel brothers, Rushton Jr. and John, who said they needed the vehicle to drive Jimmy back to his home, which was located 11 miles away. According to Helen and Jeffrey, they all climbed out of the Continental before it was driven away. The 2 friends would later say that Tommy spent a good chunk of the evening flirting with Martha, and they witnessed him playfully push Martha onto the front lawn before he fell on top of her. This prompted Helen and Jeffrey to part ways with them and head home, but this would turn out to be the last time Martha was confirmed to be alive. Even though Martha's curfew was 9:30, she never returned to her house, and while Dorothy was annoyed and planned to wait out for Martha, she wound up falling asleep on the couch while watching TV. Dorothy woke up at around 2 a.m. on October the 31st and was surprised to discover that Martha was not in her bedroom and had still not arrived home, so Dorothy started calling a number of Martha's friends. After learning that Martha was last seen at the Skakel residence, Dorothy called them, and when Julie answered the phone, she agreed to wake up Tommy. Tommy told Dorothy that he parted ways with Martha at 9:30 and last saw her walking in the direction of her house, but he had no idea where she was. Dorothy had her son John search the neighborhood for Martha, but he failed to find her, so Dorothy contacted the Greenwich Police Department in order to report Martha missing. When Martha failed to resurface by morning, Dorothy walked over to the Skakel residence at around 8 a.m., and Michael answered the door. While Halloween was a holiday for Martha and all the other students at Greenwich High School, it was not a day off for the students of Brunswick School, the private school where the Skakel children attended. Therefore, Dorothy was a bit surprised that Michael answered the door, and she said that he appeared to be hungover. Nonetheless, Michael enlisted the family's servants to help perform a search of the property for Martha, and they even checked a camper which was parked outside to see if she might have spent the night there, but Martha was nowhere to be found. Well, at 12:45 p.m., 15 hours after Martha was last seen, one of her friends was taking a shortcut through the Moxley's backyard when she stumbled across Martha's body lying face down beneath a pine tree. She immediately informed the Moxley family about this, as well as a pair of police officers who were searching the neighborhood for Martha. The backyard was soon sealed off as a crime scene, and it turned out that Martha had been struck in the head with a blunt instrument at least 8 or 9 times and was stabbed in the neck 5 times. Martha's jeans and underwear were pulled down around her knees, but it would turn out that she was not sexually assaulted and no traces of semen were found on her body or at the scene. There was a blood trail across the yard to indicate that Martha was originally attacked on a grassy area in the middle of the residence's driveway. She was then dragged to a more secluded section of the property where she was attacked some more, and her body was left approximately 80 feet from the driveway. And since there were traces of blood on the inside of Martha's jeans and underwear, they were likely pulled down before the majority of the injuries were inflicted upon her. The head of a steel Tony Pennebrand Lady 6 iron golf club was found on the grassy area in the middle of the driveway. An 11-inch piece of the club shaft was lying near 2 large pools of blood, and another 8-inch piece of the shaft was on the property. It was theorized that the killer had struck Martha with the golf club so hard that it wound up snapping into 4 separate pieces, or they broke the club themselves in a fit of rage. The jagged 1-foot handle of the club shaft was likely used to stab Martha in the neck, but this piece of the club was never found. The state's chief medical examiner, Dr. Elliot Gross, determined that Martha's exact cause of death was a fractured skull and bruises to the brain, and his initial estimation was that she was killed sometime between 10 p.m. on October the 30th and 5 a.m. on October the 31st. 2 months later, Dr. Joseph Yakimchik, the chief medical examiner of Harris County, Texas, was brought in to assist in the investigation, and after viewing Dr. Gross's autopsy, Dr. Yakimchik narrowed the estimated time of death and concluded that Martha was likely killed sometime between 9:45 and 10 p.m. Indeed, numerous witnesses from the neighborhood, including Dorothy Moxley, would recall hearing some dogs barking wildly during this time frame, which may have been the reaction to seeing Martha get attacked. Dorothy had been painting her bedroom upstairs and also thought she might have heard male teenage voices outside, but when she looked through the window into her yard, she saw nothing. Martha's funeral took place on November the 4th, and since she was such a popular and well-liked person within the community, around 500 people attended, and there was not enough room for everyone inside the church. This marked the first time that the Greenwich PD had to investigate a homicide in 26 years, and since Belhaven was an affluent gated community not known for violent crime, the residents initially suspected that the killer was an outsider. Well, things went in an unexpected direction when one of the detectives was performing a search of the Skakel residence and noticed a 5-iron Tony Penna brand ladies' golf club inside a barrel in a hallway leading to the back door. The set of clubs had belonged to Ann Skakel and were passed down to her daughter Julie after she died. Since Tony Penna clubs were fairly rare and the 6-iron from the set could not be found, it seemed to be a probable match to the broken club found at Martha's murder scene. Furthermore, the 5-iron had a leather handle listing the name Mrs. R.W. Skakel and the same handle, which had likely been used to stab Martha in the neck, was the one piece of the broken six iron which could not be recovered. Now, while this seemed to suggest that someone from the Skakel residence may have attacked Martha, Rushton Skakel Sr. said that it wasn't unusual for his kids to carelessly leave the golf clubs lying around and offered an alternative explanation. Rushton had recently held a company picnic at his residence in which a number of guests used his family's clubs to putt on the back lawn, so if he wondered if perhaps the six iron might have been left outside and a stranger happened to find it and used it as the murder weapon on Martha. Since Tommy Skakel was the last known person to see Martha alive, he was investigated as a potential suspect. A search of Martha's diary would uncover entries in which she wrote that Tommy had previously attempted to, quote-unquote, get to first and second base with me by doing stuff like putting his hand on her knee and putting his arms around her until she fended him off. Indeed, Helen X and Jeffrey Byrne would confirm that while they were sitting in the Lincoln Continental together, Martha had rebuffed Tommy when he touched her leg. Tommy continued to stick to his original story that he parted ways with Martha at around 9:30 p.m., and last saw her walking towards her residence before he went inside his house and spent the next little while in his bedroom working on a school paper about Abraham Lincoln. However, when investigators spoke to Tommy's teachers at a school, they all denied ever having given him any assignments on Abraham Lincoln. Martha's diary also contained an entry about having once been confronted by Michael Skakel while he was intoxicated, as he told her to stop leading Tommy on. As you might recall, Michael had been sitting inside the Continental with Martha and Tommy before their brothers Rushton Jr. and John told them that they needed the vehicle to drive their cousin, Jimmy Therrien, home. Michael told the police that he accompanied his brothers to Jimmy's house and invited Martha to come along, but she declined since she needed to be home for curfew. When the Skakel brothers arrived at Jimmy's place, they all watched the comedy series Monty Python's Flying Circus on television. And after they drove back to the Skakel residence at around 11:30 p.m., Michael said that he went straight to bed. Some suspicion would also be directed at 23-year-old Kenneth Littleton, who had worked as a teacher and coach at the Brunswick School, but was hired by Rushton Skakel to be a live-in tutor for his children. In fact, Littleton moved into the Skakel residence on the morning of October the 30th, and since Rushton was out of town on a hunting trip, Littleton took most of the children to a Belhaven country club for dinner that night and would be in charge of babysitting them when they returned home. When questioned by police, Littleton claimed that he spent the majority of the evening watching the Academy Award-winning film The French Connection, which was making its network premiere on television. At around 9:45 p.m., Littleton said that the family's housekeeper told him that she heard an odd noise outside her window. After checking on the two youngest children, David and Stephen, Littleton went outside the residence, but even though he thought he might have heard some noises from behind the bushes on the property, he claimed he did not see anything. Littleton then went back inside and continued watching The French Connection on TV, and said that Tommy eventually joined him on the couch at around 10:15. If you're wondering about Martha's boyfriend, Peter Zaluka, he claimed that his mother had asked if he wanted to take the family car to see Martha on the evening of October the 30th, but he did not have a license, and had also smoked pot earlier that day, so Peter elected to stay home to watch The French Connection on TV before he fell asleep. Some entries in Martha's diary revealed that a relationship with Peter could be a rocky one, as he was prone to mood swings, and she was willing to kiss other boys while she was still dating him. But after Peter was questioned and passed a polygraph, investigators ruled him out as a suspect. Over the course of the next several months, over 200 people would be interviewed by police, many of whom consented to polygraph tests. Tommy was given two tests, but while the results of the first one was inconclusive, he wound up passing the second. There was no evidence to implicate anyone from Belhaven in Martha's murder, though as the years went on, there would be complaints about a possible conflict of interest between the Greenwich PD and some of the neighborhood's residents. The area's wealthier families, including the Skakels, would sometimes give off-duty police officers the opportunity to earn extra money by performing such tasks as security work and driving their kids to school. One investigator would later say that while all of Belhaven's residents were very nice and cooperative when they were first questioned by police, they would become agitated if they had to be re-interviewed for a second time and express their frustration that the killer had not yet been caught. Due to the Skakel's influence, the Greenwich PD would face allegations that they gave the family special treatment and did not investigate them as thoroughly as they should have. While Rushton and Skakel did consent for the police to do a cursory search of his residence, they never took the initiative to obtain a warrant in order to perform a thorough search, even though the actual murder weapon originated from there. Believe it or not, one of their so-called searches involved the police asking Julie to check through the house on their behalf without any supervision, and they pretty much took her word for it when she said she didn't find anything. The Skakels did cooperate with investigators, but in January of 1976, they announced that on the advice of their attorney, the family was no longer going to submit themselves to any further questioning from the police. Even though Rushton had initially given investigators permission to access Tommy's school and mental health records, he abruptly withdrew his consent before they had a chance to view them, and would not allow them to give Tommy a medical or psychiatric exam. 6 months after Kenneth Littleton was hired as their live-in tutor, he was dismissed by the Skakel family after their eldest children produced failing grades in school, and Littleton would once again become the focal point of the investigation. In July of 1976, Littleton was arrested in Nantucket, Massachusetts, on the charges of burglary and larceny after he went on a crime spree while under the influence of alcohol and cocaine. A number of people who knew Littleton said that his personality seemed to change following Martha Moxley's murder, and he had developed a drinking problem. While he was in custody, police extensively interrogated Littleton about the crime, and he wound up failing a polygraph, though he claimed this was likely caused by the stress of his other pending criminal charges. In the end, Littleton never confessed, and there was no evidence to implicate him in the murder, and after he agreed to plead guilty to the burglary and larceny charges, he received a sentence of 5 years probation. Nonetheless, Littleton's life continued on a downward spiral as he had a hard time holding down a job and would be charged and convicted of a number of different offenses, including multiple DUIs. Littleton suffered from manic depression and even spent some time in a psychiatric hospital following a suicide attempt. For 7 years, Littleton was married to a woman named Mary Baker, and they had 2 children together, but he continued to drink heavily and suffer psychotic breaks. After they divorced, Mary claimed that Kenneth left a message on her answering machine threatening to kill her, so in 1991, the Greenwich PD set up a sting operation in a motel room. They had Mary wear a wire in hopes that she could get her ex-husband to confess to Martha's murder, but he never did and was not recorded saying anything incriminating. As for the Moxley family, they decided to move out of Greenwich in order to relocate to such places as Manhattan and Annapolis, Maryland. Tragically, in November of 1988, David Moxley suffered a fatal heart attack at the age of 57 without seeing justice for what happened to his daughter. Dorothy Moxley eventually settled in Chatham, New Jersey, while her son John got married and had 2 children. However, in 1991, Martha's murder would return to the spotlight for unexpected reasons. On March the 29th of that year, 30-year-old William Kennedy Smith, a nephew of Robert F. Kennedy, who also happened to be a cousin of the Skakel children, was at a bar in Palm Beach, Florida, and met a woman named Patricia Bowman, who would later accuse William of violently raping her on the beach. He was subsequently charged with rape, but maintained that their sex had been consensual, and he wound up being acquitted when his trial took place in December. But the massive publicity surrounding the story caused rumors to circulate that a teenage William had been present at the Skakel residence on the night of Martha's murder, and there was even speculation that he could have been involved in the crime. These rumors turned out to be false, since William was definitely not in Belhaven on that particular night, but they seemed to help rejuvenate interest in the Moxley case. Back in 1982, Leonard Levitt, a beat reporter for Newsday, had been recruited by the editors of the Greenwich Time and Stanford Advocate newspapers to write an extensive story about the murder. Levitt and another reporter named Kevin Donovan went through 400 pages of police documents and conducted more than 100 interviews to put together this article, but even though they submitted multiple drafts over the next several years, the article was never published. However, once the William Kennedy Smith rape made headlines and Levitt started speaking about the Moxley case to other media outlets, the Greenwich Time agreed to run the article in August of 1991. This prompted the Greenwich PD to reopen the investigation, and in response, Rushton Skakel Sr. decided to procure the services of a Long Island-based private detective agency called the Sutton Associates, who would perform their own independent investigation. Since the Skakel family, particularly Tommy and Michael, had always lived under a cloud of suspicion, Rushton was hoping that the new investigation might clear their names, and the findings would be published in a document known as the Sutton Report. Well, for the next few years, the Sutton Report was kept private until a former employee from the agency stole a copy of the report and leaked it to noted true crime writer Dominic Dunn. Dunn had developed a fascination with this case after covering the William Kennedy Smith rape trial for Vanity Fair magazine, so much so that he decided to write a fictional novel inspired by the story titled A Season in Purgatory. The book was released in 1993, and its plot involved the murder of a teenage girl whose killer is revealed to be a member of a politically powerful family, and it seemed clear that this character was modeled on Tommy Skakel. The Sutton Report was eventually passed on to Leonard Levitt, who published another extensive article about the case in Newsday in November of 1995, which contained some shocking revelations. It turned out that when Tommy and Michael were interviewed by the Sutton Associates, they both changed their original stories about their alibis on the night of Martha's murder. Instead of saying that Martha headed back home at 9:30 p.m. while he went inside his house, Tommy now claimed that he remained outdoors and spent an additional 20 minutes with Martha, and they proceeded to engage in some sexual activity together, which included heavy petting and mutual masturbation, before they went their separate ways. Back in 1975, Michael had told police that he returned home from his cousin's house at 11:30 p.m. and went straight to bed, but he now told the Sutton Associates that he decided to go back outside and head to the cottage where the family's housekeeper lived, since she apparently had a habit of undressing in front of her window with the blinds down. But since her lights were out, Michael then decided to head to the Moxley property and proceeded to climb a tree so he could peep into Martha's bedroom. He threw some pebbles at her window, but there was no response, and it turned out that he was actually tossing pebbles at her brother's bedroom by mistake, and John was still awake downstairs. Michael then said that he decided to start masturbating before he abruptly stopped and climbed back down the tree. While Michael recalled hearing what might have been some noises from the bushes, he said he did not see anything unusual before he headed back home. The 1970s were a rough time for Michael and Tommy, as they were both known for having emotional problems and being prone to angry outbursts. Rushton struggled with alcoholism and was not exactly known for being a compassionate father, as he did not do much to help his children deal with the grief of losing their mother. Rushton was also particularly harsh and abusive towards Michael, who started developing an alcohol problem of his own at the young age of 13. He was also a poor student who flunked out of a number of different schools, as he struggled with dyslexia and did not receive an official diagnosis for this until adulthood. In March of 1978, Michael was arrested in Windham, New York, after he was pulled over for speeding while intoxicated and nearly ran over a police officer when he attempted to flee the scene. In order to avoid criminal charges, his family agreed to send him to the Elon School, a therapeutic boarding school for troubled youths located in Poland, Maine. After residing there for 2 years, Michael would continue to spend time in and out of multiple alcohol and drug rehabilitation facilities before he finally became sober. By the 1990s, both brothers seemed to be doing well, as Tommy was a successful businessman with a wife and 2 children, and Michael had gotten married to golfer Margot Sheridan. Michael also found success on the international speed skiing circuit and even tried out for the speed skiing demonstration team that appeared at the 1992 Winter Olympics. However, the fact that Michael and Tommy changed their stories about their whereabouts on the night of Martha's murder caused the Sutton Associates to conclude that they had both lied to the authorities, only increasing suspicion that one or both of them might be involved in the crime. When the Greenwich PD reopened the investigation, Michael and Tommy would not consent to new interviews, but they both claimed that the reason they did not tell investigators the complete story back in 1975 was because they feared that admitting to sexual activity with Martha or masturbation would anger their father. In February of 1996, Martha's case would be profiled on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, but on the advice of their attorneys, Tommy and Michael declined to be interviewed on the show. The segment did feature noted forensic pathologist Dr. Henry Lee, who had been brought in to take a fresh look at some of the evidence with new technology. Less than a week after Martha's murder, some trash collectors had discovered a pair of jeans and sneakers in the Skakel family's garbage bins and decided to turn them over to the police. These items apparently belonged to a friend of Michael's who had attended summer camp with them in New Hampshire, and after they swapped clothing, Michael brought the items home after camp ended. There were dark stains on the bottom of the jeans and the tops of the sneakers, though testing from the Connecticut State Police Lab determined that they were not blood. The jeans also contained a long blonde hair which was microscopically similar to Martha's, and there were other hairs that appeared to belong to a Caucasian male. But since Henry Lee did not have hair samples from anyone in the Skakel family at that time, he could not make a forensic comparison. After studying the crime scene photographs, Lee reached the conclusion that Martha's murder was a sexually motivated homicide, and since there were no noticeable defensive wounds on her body, this seemed to suggest that she may have known her attacker and was the victim of a crime of passion from someone who took out a lot of rage and anger on her. Lee also noticed reddish marks on Martha's inner thighs, which could have been caused when the killer used their bloody hands to attempt to push Martha's legs apart. While it was announced during the Unsolved Mystery segment that a $50,000 reward was being offered for information, and after the episode aired, two witnesses would come forward who claimed they had heard Michael make incriminating statements after he was sent to the Elon School 2 decades earlier. Both these witnesses were former Elon School residents, and one of them was John Higgins, who claimed that Michael initially said that he thought he may have committed a murder and blacked out. While he didn't remember the crime, Michael did say that he had a recollection of taking a golf club from a bin inside his family's garage during a party and running through the woods. According to Higgins, as the conversation progressed, Michael went from saying, quote-unquote, he didn't know whether he did it, to, quote, he may have done it, to, quote, he must have done it, before he finally admitted, quote, I did it. The second former Elon School student was Gregory Coleman, who had been assigned to guard Michael after he made an escape attempt from the facility. Coleman claimed that Michael confessed to killing Martha because she had rejected his sexual advances. After recounting how he fatally hit her with a golf club, Michael then bragged, quote, I am going to get away with murder because I am a Kennedy. Michael also allegedly told Coleman that he returned to Martha's body and masturbated over it 2 days later, which was obviously not true since she was found the day after she was killed. However, one theory which has been pushed forward is that if Michael actually made this confession, he could have exaggerated the details of his story and actually masturbated over Martha's body shortly after she was killed. I mentioned earlier that even though Martha's pants and underwear were pulled down, she was not raped, as the chief medical examiner, Dr. Gross, did not find any traces of semen in Martha's vaginal and anal cavities. But it's worth noting that Martha was found face down, and Dr. Gross never checked for any semen on her buttocks or her back. Back in 1975, no one would have been thinking of DNA evidence, but it was starting to become a major part of criminal investigations by the early 1990s, which happened to coincide with when Michael first shared his story about masturbating in the tree on the Moxley property. So it's been speculated that Michael might have dreamed the story up in order to explain the possible presence of his DNA at the murder scene, but since no DNA evidence was ever found, this story doesn't prove or disprove anything. As time went on, a number of other eyewitnesses report having heard Michael make incriminating statements both in and outside the Elon School, but we'll talk more about that later on. In 1998, two books would be published about this case, which each had opposing ideas about who was responsible for the crime. One of them was titled Greentown, Murder and Mystery in Greenwich, America's Wealthiest Community, and it was written by former Greenwich resident Timothy Dumas, and seemed to lead towards Tommy Skakel being the killer. But the more prominent of the two books was Murder in Greenwich, written by former Los Angeles police officer Mark Furman. As you probably know, Furman attained notoriety during O.J. Simpson's trial for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, when recorded interviews surfaced of Furman using racist language, even though he had denied ever using racist epithets while testifying under oath during the trial. And of course, it's always been suspected that Furman's questionable testimony played a role in convincing the jury to find O.J. Simpson not guilty. Well, since Dominic Dunn provided extensive coverage at the Simpson trial and had developed a newfound interest in the Moxley case, he encouraged Furman to perform his own investigation into the murder and write a book about it. The end result was Murder in Greenwich, and Furman pulled no punches In expressing his belief that Michael Skakel committed the crime and killed Martha in a fit of jealousy after seeing her kiss Tommy. Furman also accused the Greenwich PD of making numerous mistakes during the original investigation. For instance, even though the handle of the six iron golf club used to murder Martha was supposedly never found, Furman spoke with two former Greenwich police officers, along with the Moxley family's former doctor, who were certain that they saw this handle at the murder scene when Martha's body was discovered, before it vanished without explanation. The Greenwich PD did not cooperate much with Furman during his research for the book, claiming they did not want to jeopardize an ongoing investigation, and following the book's release, they heavily criticized it and said it was full of errors. For the past two decades, Donald Brown, the state's attorney for the Judicial District of Fairfield, was reluctant to convene a grand jury for the case, as he felt there was not enough evidence pointing to any particular suspect. But following Brown's retirement, his successor, Jonathan Benedict, seemed to feel differently. Indeed, in June of 1998, just a few weeks after Murder in Greenwich came out, Benedict assembled a one-man grand jury in which Fairfield District Superior Court Judge George Thim would review the evidence from the case. This meant that Judge Thim could subpoena witnesses to testify, something that law enforcement investigators had been unable to do. The grand jury investigation would last 18 months, and over 50 witnesses were called upon to provide testimony during closed-door sessions. One of these witnesses was Kenneth Littleton, who was granted immunity for sharing everything he knew about Martha's murder. Well, after the grand jury investigation was completed, Judge Thim issued his final report, in which he concluded that there was enough evidence to charge Michael Skakel for Martha's murder. On January the 19th, 2000, a warrant was issued for Michael's arrest, and after he surrendered, he was taken into custody. Michael then entered a not guilty plea before being released on a $500,000 bail. 2 months later, Michael was arraigned for the murder in juvenile court, as he had been a minor when the crime took place. He actually stood face to face with Dorothy Moxley in the courtroom and said to her, quote, "I feel your pain, but you've got the wrong guy." By this point, Michael was 39 years old and had a 3-year-old son with his wife Margo, but she would file for divorce shortly after he was charged. For the next year, there would be a lot of legal wrangling about whether or not Michael should stand trial as a juvenile, which meant that the maximum prison sentence he could receive for the crime was 4 years in a youth treatment facility. But on January the 31st, 2001, a juvenile court judge ruled that Michael would be tried as an adult, since she did not believe that Connecticut's juvenile system was equipped to punish a defendant who was Michael's age. His trial finally began in Norwalk, Connecticut on May the 7th, 2002, and would be prosecuted by Jonathan Benedict, while Michael was represented by defense attorney Mickey Sherman. The case against Michael would be very circumstantial, as there was no actual physical evidence linking him to the crime. In fact, those jeans and sneakers I mentioned, which had been found in the Skakel's trash bins following the murder, had somehow gone missing before the trial began. The previous August, the state's case had hit a major snag when Gregory Coleman, one of the witnesses who had allegedly heard Michael confess to murder at the Elon School, died of a drug overdose. There were credibility issues with Coleman, as he had a criminal history, and prior to his death, he had admitted that he was under the influence of heroin when he shared his story while testifying during the grand jury investigation. In spite of this, the prosecution still planned to present Coleman's original pretrial testimony to the jury, as well as corroborating testimony from two other witnesses, including Coleman's widow, who claimed that he had told them about Michael's confession years before he came forward to the authorities. The state also provided additional testimony from multiple eyewitnesses who claimed they heard Michael make incriminating statements during his time at the Elon School. I've already made mention of John Higgins, but some of these other witnesses said that Michael talked about how he'd become drunk and blacked out on the night of Martha's murder. He said that his brother Tommy had, quote-unquote, fooled around with his girlfriend and, quote-unquote, stolen her from him, and he wasn't sure if it was himself or Tommy who killed Martha. Another witness from the school, Dorothy Rogers, said that Michael told her he had been drinking on the night of the crime and did not remember what he had done, but his own family were afraid that he might have killed Martha and sent him off to the Elon School so he could stay under the radar and avoid investigators. Now, I'll go into more detail about this during our next episode, but it's worth mentioning that the Elon School, which has since been closed down, is a subject of major controversy as many former students have claimed that they endured mental and physical abuse at the hands of staff as part of a behavioral modification program. The defense presented testimony from witnesses who claimed that the school's founder, Joseph Ritchie, forced Michael to wear a sign which read, quote, "I am an arrogant rich brat, confront me on why I killed Martha." During group therapy sessions, Ritchie would allegedly confront Michael and try to get him to admit to the murder, and when he refused to do so, Michael was forced to climb into a boxing ring in order to be verbally and physically abused by other students. The defense said that in order to bring a stop to this abuse, Michael went from denying involvement in Martha's murder to saying that he didn't know if he had killed her. However, the prosecution provided testimony from a couple of eyewitnesses who supposedly heard Michael make some incriminating statements about the crime before he was even sent to the Elon School. Michael's former barber, Matthew Tuccaroni, testified that during the spring of 1976, Michael had come into his shop for a haircut alongside his sister Julie. When Michael made a statement about wanting to kill someone, Julie said he couldn't do that, to which Michael allegedly replied, quote, "Why not? I did it before. I killed before." Lauren Ciccarelli, the Skakel family's former chauffeur and handyman, would also testify that during the spring of 1977, he drove Michael to New York City for an appointment. Michael had apparently just had a fight with his father and told Ciccarelli that he had, quote-unquote, done something really bad and he either had to, quote-unquote, kill himself or get out of the country. Later that day, while they were stuck in traffic on the Triborough Bridge in New York, Ciccarelli said that Michael abruptly climbed out of the car and threatened to jump off the bridge before Ciccarelli caught up to him and forced him back into the vehicle. When Ciccarelli asked Michael why he did this, he supposedly replied, quote, "If you knew what I had done, you would never talk to me again." Ciccarelli was left so perturbed by the incident that he immediately quit working for the Skakels. Testimony was also provided by Mildred X, a close friend of the Skakel family, who also happened to be the mother of Martha's friend, Helen X. Mildred claimed that sometime in 1981, Rushton Skakel had confided in her that Michael might have been responsible for Martha's murder. In 1997, Michael was hoping to share his side of the story and submitted a proposal for a book titled Dead Man Talking, A Kennedy Cousin Comes Clean, stating, quote, "I am a member of a family sick unto death with generations of secrets." The prosecution would present recorded audio of Michael speaking with Richard Hoffman, a ghostwriter who had been hired for this project. While Michael never admitted any complicity in the crime, he could be heard saying that he wanted Martha to be his girlfriend and had been feeling, quote-unquote, horny on the night of her death. This prompted him to leave his house and head over to Martha's residence to peek through her window, as he said he was thinking, quote, "Martha likes me, I'll go get a kiss from Martha, I'll be bold tonight," end quote. Michael then recounted his story about masturbating in the tree, but also said that when Dorothy Moxley went to his house and spoke with him the following morning, he panicked and thought to himself, quote, "Oh my God, I hope to God nobody saw me." Now, this would be the source of some controversy, because Michael's full statement had actually been, quote, "Oh my God, I hope to God nobody saw me jerking off." But when the prosecution played the audio, they cut out the words, "jerking off." During the state's closing arguments, Michael's audio was played over a multimedia presentation in which graphic images of Martha's dead body were put on display. The defense believed that the prosecution was unfairly influencing the jury and that by cutting out the words "jerking off" from Michael's statement, they were creating the false impression that he meant, quote, "I hope to God nobody saw me commit the murder." The crux of the defense's case would be Michael's alibi, as he always maintained that he had traveled with his two brothers, Rushton Jr. and John, to their cousin Jimmy Tarian's residence 11 miles away and were watching Monty Python's Flying Circus on television during the time period Martha was murdered. Well, the prosecution countered by attempting to poke holes in the alibi. While Jimmy and Rushton Jr. testified that Michael had been with them at Jimmy's house that night, John acknowledged that he could not actually remember for certain. Jimmy's sister, George Ann Dowdle, testified that she did recall hearing the voices of some of the Skakel boys at the residence during this time period, but she could not identify which ones. During her original statement to police, Julie Skakel said that she had seen someone running through her yard at 9:30 p.m. and thought it might be Michael, but she now claimed that she could no longer be certain it was him, since a lot of kids were running around the neighborhood on mischief night. However, Julie's best friend at that time, Andrea Shakespeare Renna, had also been present at the Skakel residence that night, and she testified that she was certain that Michael was not in the Lincoln Continental with his two brothers when it drove away, as she specifically recalled Julie yelling at him, quote, "Michael, come back here," after the car already left. The prosecution would also attempt to imply that the Skakel family may have conspired to fabricate an alibi for Michael. On the day Martha's body was found, Rushton Skakel Sr. had supposedly asked Kenneth Littleton to drive Tommy, John, and Jimmy Tarrion to the family's hunting lodge in Windham, New York. It was theorized that Rushton Sr. may have used this opportunity to get them out of town and help them concoct a cover story about Michael being at Jimmy's residence at the time of the murder before they spoke to the police. Indeed, when Michael was formally questioned at the police station a few weeks later, Rushton was present in the room when he presented his alibi. The state also attempted to discredit Michael's alibi by widening Martha's estimated time of death. Former Harris County Medical Examiner Joseph Yakimchek was brought in to testify, and while he still believed that Martha was killed sometime between 9:45 and 10 p.m., the current Chief State Medical Examiner, Dr. Harold Carver, testified that it was impossible to determine her exact time of death. While Carver believed that the evidence was consistent with Martha being killed between 9:30 and 10 o'clock, he also acknowledged that the murder could have taken place as late as 1:30 a.m. If this assessment was accurate, then Michael still would have had time to commit the crime, since he had returned home from his cousin's residence at 11:30 p.m. Michael never took the stand to testify on his own behalf, and near the end of the trial, Tommy showed up to attend. Since the two brothers were estranged at this point, this was reportedly the first time they had been in the same room together for decades. The trial lasted for over 3 weeks before it went to the jury, and on June the 7th, after more than 3 days of deliberation, they found Michael guilty of murder. They believed that the circumstantial evidence was strong enough to convict Michael beyond a reasonable doubt, and one juror, Kathy Lazansky, would tell the press, quote, "We worked very, very hard to find something that would acquit Michael Skakel. We just couldn't," end quote. Michael would later be sentenced to 20 years to life in prison, but he continued to maintain his innocence and would make a rambling 10-minute statement in front of the court, which was full of biblical references. On January the 2nd, 2003, 7 months after Michael's conviction, Rushton Skakel Sr. passed away at the age of 79. But around the same time period, Michael gained a very vocal public supporter. His cousin, Robert Kennedy Jr., who is the third-born child of Robert and Ethel Kennedy. Now, I'll go into more detail about this in our next episode, but Robert Kennedy Jr. is a very controversial figure for a variety of reasons, but he's also been steadfast in his belief that Michael was railroaded. RFK Jr. published an article about this for Atlantic Magazine titled "A Miscarriage of Justice," where he alleged that his cousin was innocent and the victim of a witch hunt orchestrated by Dominic Dunn. In 2016, Robert Jr. also published another book about this case titled "Framed: Why Michael Skakel Spent Over a Decade in Prison for a Murder He Didn't Commit." Michael's defense attorneys appealed his conviction and argued that his trial should have taken place in juvenile court, but this appeal was denied. But in 2007, the defense filed a motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence which they believed pointed towards alternate suspects. Shortly after RFK Jr.'s Atlantic article was published in 2003, the Skakel family was contacted by Tony Bryant, a former classmate of Michael's at the Brunswick School, who also happened to be the cousin of famous basketball star Kobe Bryant. Bryant was 14 years old at the time of Martha's murder, and claimed that he often visited Bellhaven with two teenage friends of his from the Bronx, Adolph Hasbrook and Burton Tinsley. Bryant claimed that Hasbrook had a major crush on Martha and once told him that he was going to, quote-unquote, take her caveman style. The three friends went to Bellhaven on mischief night in 1975, and at one point during the evening, Bryant said that he saw Hasbrook holding up a golf club which may have been grabbed from the Skakel family's yard, and he said, quote, "I got my caveman club, and I'm going to grab somebody and pull them by the hair and do what cavemen do," end quote. Bryant later became separated from Hasbrook and Tinsley, but a few days later, he heard them making statements like, quote, "I got mine, we did what we had to do, we did it, we achieved our fantasy," end quote. Once Bryant learned about Martha Moxley's murder, He suspected that Hasbrook and Tinsley might have been responsible, but he decided not to come forward until 2003. He claimed his mother had warned him not to contact the police, as he was a black man connected to the murder of a white girl in an affluent neighborhood, so she feared they would attempt to frame him for the crime. But since Bryant believed that Michael had been wrongfully convicted, he agreed to share his story during an on-camera interview with private investigators who had been hired by the Skakel family. It turned out that two unidentified hairs were found on a police blanket used to wrap Martha's body. One of them appeared to belong to an African-American male, and the other had Asian characteristics, and Tinsley was a mixture of Native American and Asian. Robert Kennedy Jr. has publicly claimed that the hairs were either lost or destroyed, so they've never been tested for DNA, but an alternate explanation is that the African-American hair may have actually belonged to a black Greenwich police officer who was present at the murder scene when Martha was found. Adolph Hasbrook was interviewed by one of the Skakels' private investigators, and he reportedly gave inconsistent statements about his whereabouts on October the 30th, 1975. Hasbrook did initially consent to a polygraph, but then later called up the private investigator and changed his mind, claiming that he had, quote-unquote, checked his books and confirmed that he was not in Bellhaven on the night of the murder. When Hasbrook and Tinsley were subpoenaed by the Skakel family to testify at a civil deposition, they both took the Fifth Amendment and declined to answer any questions on the advice of their attorneys. Hasbrook's attorney would later deny all the allegations against him, claiming that Hasbrook had never even met Martha Moxley and had no idea who she was. This new information would be presented in Superior Court by Michael's defense team, but Tony Bryant refused to appear at a hearing and share his story under oath unless he got immunity for potential culpability in the crime. The state argued that Bryant had major credibility issues as he had a prior criminal history for armed robbery and would later serve time in prison for tax evasion. Furthermore, there were no eyewitnesses who recalled having seen Bryant, Hasbrook, or Tinsley at Bellhaven on the night of the murder. So in October of 2007, a Superior Court judge denied the defense's request for a new trial. In October of 2012, Michael received his first opportunity at parole, but since he continued to deny any involvement in Martha's murder, his request for parole was denied. Well, by this point, Michael was being represented by new defense counsel, so they would file a new appeal, arguing that his original trial attorney, Mickey Sherman, had been incompetent. During the time period when the trial took place, Sherman had failed to pay 2 years' worth of federal income taxes totaling more than $420,000, and in 2010, he was sentenced to serve 1 year in a minimum security prison camp. Michael's new attorneys alleged that Sherman's own financial problems had prevented him from mounting an adequate defense, and that some of his biggest errors included neglecting to implicate Tommy as a potential alternate suspect, failing to rebut the testimony of the former students from the Elon School, and not calling upon a key witness who could have substantiated Michael's alibi. The witness in question was Dennis Osorio, the former boyfriend of Jimmy Tarion's sister, George Ann Dowdle. An evidentiary hearing was held, in which Osorio testified that he was at Jimmy's household on the evening of October the 30th, 1975, and saw Michael watching Monty Python's Flying Circus on television alongside his two brothers. In fact, Osorio even recalled speaking with Michael at one point. Well, the defense's argument seemed to sway Tolan Judicial Superior Court Judge Thomas Bishop, because on October the 23rd, 2013, he vacated Michael's conviction and granted him a new trial. In his decision, Judge Bishop wrote, quote, "The defense of a serious felony prosecution requires attention to detail, an energetic investigation, and a coherent plan of defense that is capably executed. Trial counsel's failures in each of these areas of representation were significant and ultimately fatal to a constitutionally adequate defense. As a consequence of trial counsel's failures as stated, the state procured a judgment of conviction that lacks reliability." End quote. In particular, Bishop referred to Sherman's failure to call Dennis Osorio to the witness stand as, quote-unquote, constitutionally inexcusable. The state announced their intention to appeal this ruling, but in the meantime, Michael would be released from prison on a $1.2 million bond and strictly monitored with a GPS device. Well, after 3 more years of legal wrangling, the Connecticut Supreme Court took an extensive look at Judge Bishop's decision and on December the 30th, 2016, they voted by a 4-3 majority decision to reinstate Michael's conviction. They believe that Mickey Sherman's representation at Michael's trial had been adequate and did not put much weight on Dennis Osorio's new alibi testimony, as there was still a possibility that Martha could have been killed after Michael arrived home at 11:30 p.m. Michael was allowed to remain free on bond while his defense team appealed this decision, and there would continue to be new developments. In April of 2017, Michael's attorney announced that the missing handle from Ann Skakel's 6-iron Tony Penna golf club had supposedly been found at the residence of Michael's cousin, Jimmy Tarian. The story goes that the handle was discovered by the property's groundskeeper and his daughter, and they turned it over to the Greenwich PD in 1999, but there was apparently no official report for this. In the end, the handle was never located, and I do not believe this lead ever went anywhere. By the start of 2018, the state would ask the Connecticut Supreme Court to revoke Michael's bond and have him returned to prison to continue serving a sentence, but they would receive some surprising news a few months later. On May the 4th, the Connecticut Supreme Court announced that after performing a thorough review of their previous decision, they had voted by a 4-3 majority to reverse their original decision, so Michael's conviction was vacated for the second time, and he was once again granted a new trial. Well, it turned out that Justice Peter Zarella, who wrote the majority opinion when Michael's conviction was reinstated in 2016, had retired only one day after his opinion was authored, and he was replaced by Justice Gregory DeOria. This completely changed the makeup of the court, as DeOria felt that the conviction should be vacated and tipped the scales 4-3 in Michael's favor. When asked for comment about the decision, Dorothy Moxley stated, quote, "The experience has been just like a yo-yo. I am just so conditioned to this happening and something else happening. If something else happens, it won't surprise me in the least." End quote. The state now had to decide if they were going to retry Michael, but on October the 30th, 2020, on the exact 45-year anniversary of Martha's murder, Connecticut Chief State's Attorney Richard Colangelo informed the Superior Court that there would not be a second trial. He believed that the deaths of a number of key eyewitnesses and a lack of conclusive forensic evidence would make it difficult to prove Michael's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and secure another conviction. As a result, the murder charges against Michael were dropped, and he was officially a free man again. Michael is currently 63 years old and has never stopped maintaining his innocence. By contrast, Dorothy Moxley and her son John have never wavered from their belief that Michael is guilty. Sadly, on August the 31st, 2023, just under 2 months before the release of this episode, Dorothy passed away at the age of 91. She never received full justice for what happened to her daughter, and the full truth about who is actually responsible for the murder of Martha Moxley remains up for debate. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Until next week, at least. And yes, folks, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to leave you on yet another cliffhanger, as this brings an end to part one of our series about the murder of Martha Moxley. But I shall return next Wednesday with part two, because I've certainly got a lot to say about this case. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Jeremy Indick Connolly for narrating the opening of this episode. We've been carrying on this monthly listener voiceover contest for 6 years now, and if you've already entered, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line Trail Went Cold Contest to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released a bonus episode titled The Top 10 Dumbest Segments on Unsolved Mysteries, where I discussed some of the silliest so-called mysteries that were featured on the show. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another Halloween-themed mystery. the unexplained 1988 death of David Stone. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of those commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Amanda S., Marguerite P., and Joanna C. Thank you so much for your support. Also, at the request of his son Peter, I would like to wish a happy 50th birthday to one of our listeners, Mike Crastens, so happy birthday, Mike. And like I mentioned in the intro, if we manage to attain our goal of reaching 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of October, we'll be providing an additional extra special bonus for our patrons in November. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week, and join us again next Wednesday as we present our conclusion of this special two-part episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.